Hello, this is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lippy Turner Raman, and today we'll be talking about Aftershocks by Nadia Owusu. This book has triggers for mental health, terminal illness, sexual assault, trauma, and bereavement. What place is home for you? I was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh, grew up in England and moved to the States to go to university. When I'm in the States, I think of England as home, even though I actually have lived much longer in the States than I ever did in England. But when I go to visit my family in England, I think of USA as home. Home for me is complicated. Home and identity are fluid and can be situational. Aftershocks is the memoir of Whiting Award winner Nadia Owusu. The memoir is engrossing, moving, thought-provoking, and visceral. Aftershocks navigates an incredible amount of issues in its 300 pages. Some of the subjects Owusu covers are mental health issues, home identity, loss, madness, sexual assault, blackness, longing, belonging, abandonment, emotional and historical trauma, colonialism and post-colonial theory, colorism in black communities, systemic racism, anti-LGBTQ laws in Uganda, the Armenian genocide, terminal illness, marginalization and privilege. Woo! Just a dizzying amount of material pushed into these pages. The memoir is told in a non-linear narrative. It leaps to and fro from New York, England, Italy, Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Uganda, and covers many time frames in dizzying jumps. The book examines Owusu's relationship with her fractured family and fractured sense of self and home. In some of the chapters, Owusu also entwines the cultural, historical, and political histories of many of the countries that she's lived in. The book is composed of chapters and sections that vary in length and style. Owusu starts the memoir by stating that she doesn't view time as linear and pays more attention to meanings rather than chronology. She also admits that memories, stories, can be misrepresented by memory and embellished by imaginations. This is important and you have to keep it in mind as you read Aftershocks. We first encounter Nadia as an 8-year-old. Nadia lives in Rome, Italy, with her father, stepmother, younger sister and half-brother. She wakes up to her father making pancakes. The radio informs them of a catastrophic earthquake in Armenia. Nadia's dad, Baba, informs her that her estranged mother, who left the family when Nadia was 3, is going to visit and take her and her sister Yasmin out for the day. Her mother arrives with 2 red balloons and shaking hands. Their mother's new husband drops them off at a pizzeria, and after spending the afternoon together, she drops them back home and drives off with her husband in a blue Fiat. The earthquake and her mother's abandonment impact Nadia immensely and figure large in the memoir. The memoir is framed by using earthquakes and earthquake terminology as a metaphor for Nadia's life. Nadia tells us that she has an internal seismograph which reacts and interprets the fault lines and aftershocks of the many major earthquake-like incidences in her life. Nadia has a very cosmopolitan upbringing and has a diverse family. However, a product of this life, as glamorous as it sounds, is rootlessness and shifting identities. Nadia feels as if she has no destination, no home, that everything is a pass-through. She also has issues of loss, longing, fear and abandonment. Page 8. I was born in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, but that is only because my father happened to be stationed there at the time. He worked for a United Nations agency. My mother is an American citizen, so I became American at birth. However, I did not live in the United States until I was 18. Much of America felt familiar to me when I arrived. America is experienced everywhere in the world, but calling myself American doesn't quite feel accurate. I hold a Ghanaian passport. I've never used it, as far as I can remember. It's much easier to travel with the American one. But it was important to my father that I was officially Ghanaian. I have never been to Armenia or Turkey, except for a layover in the Istanbul airport once. For my father's job, we moved a lot. I've lived in Tanzania until I was three. At three, I moved to England to live with my Aunt Harriet for 2.5 years. I lived in England for a second time at age 12 for a term at boarding school in Surrey. From ages 5 to 8, I lived in Italy. I moved back there for 3 years at age 13. Between the ages of 8 and 10, I lived in Ethiopia. From 10 to 12, and then again from 16 to 18, I lived in Uganda. My stepmother, Annabel, is from a small village on the Tanzanian side of Mount Kilimanjaro. My mother's second husband was Somali. So I have two half-sisters and a half-brother who are Armenian, Somali, American. And my half-brother on my father's side, Kwame, is Ghanaian and Tanzanian. When I turned 18, I moved to New York, where I have lived for my entire adult life. New York is kind of home. Confused? Me too. I never know how to answer the question of my origin. At 28, Nadia is living in New York City. On a lunch date, her visiting stepmother, goaded into anger by Nadia, tells Nadia that her beloved father didn't die of a brain cancer when she was nearly 14, but rather of AIDS. Nadia doesn't believe it, won't believe it, chalks it up to Annabel being vicious and mean. Meanness, a game that both women have indulged in since they met 22 years ago, when they both competed for the attention of Nadia's father. Nadia is deeply depressed. Nadia's longtime boyfriend, George, has just broken up with her, and she is seeing a psychiatrist and is on antidepressants. She just wants the pills to keep coming. She spends a day just walking all over New York, walking for 8 hours straight. On the way home, in the rain, she picks up a blue rocking chair from the sidewalk. Blue was her father's favourite colour, and in every home that she's ever lived, there's always been a rocking chair. Her father would rock watching the news, the stars, lightning. He would rock as he read to Nadia, rocking her to sleep, and rock as he told her Ghanaian myths, stories that gave order to things and had satisfying endings. Rocking makes Nadia feel closer to her father, calmer, makes things seem distant, gives her peace. After getting the chair home, Nadia has a harrowing psychic break, and she rocks and rocks for 7 days in the blue chair. Nadia spends those 7 days in altered states, relieving her memories and examining and re-examining the stories that she's told herself about her family, her mother, her father, and herself. She assesses who she was, is, her relationship with her mother, father, and stepmother, how her experiences and the experiences of her ancestors have impacted and shaped her, and how she's come to be on that blue chair rocking. Nadia's Ghanaian father, Osai, met her American Armenian mother, Almas, when he came to Cambridge, Massachusetts for his PhD. He was the hope and dreams of a post-colonial Ghana, and her mother was the product of immigrants fleeing the Armenian genocide in Turkey. Nadia's father wanted to change the world to make it a better place for his fellow human beings. Her mother wanted to paint and write. The couple go to Tanzania, courtesy of the United Nations, and Nadia and her sister Yasmin are born just a year apart. And when Nadia is three, their mother leaves the family to marry a Somalian man. She has a child soon after, and Nadia deduces an affair broke out to break the marriage up. She never tells us why her mother left and abandoned the family. She may have asked, but she doesn't tell us in the book. Almas's second husband is a gambler and has a second family in New York that she discovers much later. Almas goes on to marry another husband. Yasmin and Nadia spend a summer with their her mother's family, and Nadia enjoys the experience but tells her father otherwise to spare his feelings. Osei becomes both a mother and father to Nadia and Yasmin. He sends the two little girls to his sister Harriet in London since he doesn't have time to take care of them. Harriet is a nurse and already has a little girl of her own. Harriet's neighbours help her juggle work and childcare. And when she's five, Nadia's father marries Annabelle, a 21-year-old Tanzanian woman, and brings Nadia and Yasmin to live with them in Rome. Nadia and Annabelle have a love-hate relationship. They snipe, love, tolerate one another. They're both ferocious and loving with one another. Both are jealous of one another and how they are vying for Osei's attention. Nadia says that her version of the story required a villain, an evil stepmother, and Annabelle serves that function. The family visit Ghana when Nadia is seven, and Nadia's grandparents are not enamoured of Annabelle. They have stereotypes of Tanzanians, and Annabelle seems to fit them all. Her father takes the two little girls to see the Ghanaian stool house and the golden stool. Nadia explores the political and cultural history of Ghana and addresses how colonialism, slavery reverberate throughout Ghana and on her own personal topography. They go to see Elmina Castle, where slaves left by the doors of no return on the transatlantic slave trade. We learn about the active role of the Ashanti and Africans in the slave trade. This chapter also explores the shame that's assigned to blackness and how internalized racism and oppression are prevalent in African communities. Page 68. In Ghana, I learnt that calling someone bush was a common insult. My grandfather said it of a neighbour who showed up at our house drunk and wanting to borrow money. A radio commentator levied it against a politician who fell asleep during parliamentary proceedings and snored. Propriety was important to Ghanaians. A lot of stock was put in having good manners, in sticking to convention. Those ceremonies had a decidedly British flavour. This seemed to be direct conflict with the pride Ghanaians had in their own culture and pre-colonial history. I recall a song, my father's favourite, by the Nigerian musician and activist Fela Kuti, called Colonial Mentality. Colonial mentality, as defined by Kuti, is the idea that people who have been colonized, marginalized, and enslaved feel themselves inferior to their colonizers based on the very fact of their colonization. "He be say you be colonial man," Kuti sings in his beautifully rough voice, his Nigerian pidgin clear and defiant. "You don be slave man before, then don't release you now, but you never release yourself." My father stood firmly in his Ghanaian ancestry. He often wore Ghanaian print shirts to work. When a colleague in Rome invited him to the American Club to watch the US presidential election, my father declined. "Will you be watching the Ghanaian election?" my father asked his colleague. "It's also taking place this year." Above the mirror in my bedroom, my father hung a Ghanaian flag. He taught me about its meaning. "The red," he said, "is for the blood of the people who died in the struggle for independence. The gold is for the country's mineral wealth. The green for the forests. And the black star at the flag's center symbolizes black liberation." "The black star shall rise," he said. On our bookshelf, Chinua Achebe, Wolf Sonika, Nuruddin Farah, Miriam Barr, Kofi Annor held a place of honour in the centre of the top shelf. In our music collection, Fela Kuti was joined by Miriam Makeba, Salif Kayenta, Yusuf Dunur, and E.T. Menasha, and the Tempos Band. Yet, I saw in my father's use of the word bush evidence that the colonial mentality existed in him. This scared me, though I couldn't quite articulate why. Now I know it scared me because it spoke to a fault line in the African body. my body, my father's. The family moves to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, when Nadia is 8. Owusu examines how her wealth and privilege shielded her from poverty and violence in Ethiopia and in many of the other places that she lived. She lays bare the golden existence and privilege of the diplomatic life and juxtaposes it with the life of child soldiers, poverty, hunger that citizens of Addis Ababa experience outside of the walled diplomatic compound. The multicultural and interracial group inside the walls have cocktail parties, delicious and elaborate meals cooked by local chefs, cozy cottages with manicured lawns and gardens the children can fly kites in and have paddling pools and private tutors. Outside the walls are sprawling shanty towns filled with raw sewage and broken people with amputated limbs. The children can look over the walls to the other Ethiopia. Civil war starts to break out, knocking at the walls. Rebel soldiers move into Addis Ababa, and children are kidnapped to serve as child soldiers. One evening, soldiers come for the son of the family's cook. The son escapes kidnapping by sitting on a couch with Nadia and her siblings and enfolding himself within that privilege and wealth that the agency workers had. The diplomatic community is not too stressed about the strife and its impact, another manifestation of their privilege. They know they'll be taken care of and sent along for their next postings in business class. At 12, Nadia is sent to an exclusive boarding school in England. Her fees are paid by the UN agency. Nadia is only one of two black girls at the school. Agatha, a friendless student from Uganda, is hopeful that Nadia will be her friend. But Nadia knows the world works differently. She is ashamed, but also relieved, since Agatha is darker, has wider nose, fuller lips, coarser hair than her. Agatha will be on the bottom of that pecking order. The girls at the school, and especially the ringleader, Claire, let Nadia into the group because she tells them that she's American. That's the magic ticket for entrance into this clique. Agatha is excluded, called a fat gorilla. Owusu is scared that Aunt Harriet will invite Agatha to come home for the weekend with visits with her and taint her. Page 132. A month after I started school at St. Mary's, I began to find Agatha's braided extension everywhere. I found one in the shower and one in the entrance in the laundry room, one of the Belgian nuns who washed our clothes. I never learnt why the nuns were assigned jobs based on nationality. The Belgians did laundry, the Irish worked in the kitchen. Handed it to me, thinking it would be mine. Given that potential confusion, I made sure to dispose of every braid I found, wrapping them in toilet paper and throwing them into the garbage. Meanwhile, Agatha's hair began to look more and more desperate. She tried to cover it up with headbands and ribbons, but they weren't much help. Unlike me, she had no family in England. I was the only African girl she knew. One day, during PE, it was warm enough to play field hockey outside instead of playing handball in the gymnasium. We all changed into the very short green skirts and matching bloomers we wore for sports activities. We ran 3 laps around the field to warm up. Claire and Victoria jogged right in front of me. "Look at her go," Claire said, pointing to Agatha. "She looks like a gorilla, like a giant, ugly gorilla." I picked up speed and passed them. It would be easier for me to pretend not to have heard her. I ran faster than I'd ever run in my life. That night, at dinner time, Victoria found one of Agatha's braids in the bread basket as we stood in line for roast beef and potatoes. She shrieked so everyone turned to see what was happening. Claire picked up the braid with a napkin. "Oh, my days," she said. "It's Agatha's filthy weave. It probably has insects in it. I've completely gone off my food." She said this in a loud voice for all of us to hear. She dropped the braid on the floor dramatically. The hall roared with laughter. Even Sister Harris, who adored Agatha, laughed. "Nadia," Claire squealed, "are your braids going to fall off like Agatha's?" "No," I said, trying to sound light. "Mine are not fake like hers." This was, at that moment, true. But I had worn extensions in the past, I decided, right then to put a photograph of my mother on the wall behind my bed. She had olive skin and straight, silky hair. Never mind that I barely knew her. Behind me, I heard a tray slam on the counter. I turned to see Agatha walk off, calm but stiff, out of the dining hall. After that, Agatha stopped trying to talk to me before lights out. She stopped watching me. One of my favourite novels is Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eyes. It was one of the books I brought to St. Mary's with me. I did not read it while I was there, though. I think because I could see myself in it, and what I saw wasn't pretty. In the novel, Piccola longs painfully for blue eyes. She idolises Shirley Temple and detests her dark skin that even her own mother deems ugly. She's tormented at school. Whiteness, she believes, is the key to being loved. She obsessively eats candies, the wrappers of which are printed with a photo of a blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl named Mary Jane. She hopes the candy will transform her eyes to blue. She also appeals to God, but her eyes only turn blue in her mind, through madness, after she's raped by her father, gives birth to his child, and is shunned by her community. She decides everyone is jealous of her blue eyes. Perhaps her fixation on blue eyes as opposed to white skin speaks to a deep-seated knowledge that it is the world that needs to change, not her. Because she cannot change the world, she chooses to see it differently, through different eyes. I too choose not to see the world as it was. I chose not to see the horrible way Agatha was treated. The narrator in The Bluest Eyes tells us this of how people felt about Piccola. Her simplicity decorated us. Her guilt sanctified us. Her pain made us glow with health. I cannot claim that I did not relish the fact that I was accepted by Claire, while Agatha was not. I cannot claim that under Claire's blue-eyed gaze, I did not despise my guilt, glow with health. On Friday, Auntie Harriet came to take me to London. Agatha was seated on her bed reading a book. She had her headphones on. She almost always had headphones on in the dormitory now. "Aye," Aunt Harriet said, catching a glimpse of the state of affairs on Agatha's head. "We should take her with us to Wembley. Does she not have no one to braid her hair?" I could not think of a reason that would make sense to Auntie Harriet as to why Agatha should not come with us. So Auntie Harriet spoke to Sister Miller and then to Agatha, who looked up at me, surprised. Agatha called her parents, Nairobi, to ask for permission. As we walked out of the dormitory, Claire stared at us open-mouthed. There would be questions I would have to answer. My answers, I knew, would be lies. "Thank you," Agatha said to me quietly in the car. A fat tear swelled from my eye. Agatha had nothing to thank me for. I would be nice to her while we were in London, but things would not change when we were at school, not if I could help it. She observed me silently, smiling a sad little smile. Then she turned to look out the window. It was grey and raining. It was always either grey or raining or both. "Whoever these English people did to deserve this weather," Agatha said, "must have been bad. Very bad." Nadia's father is dying of cancer and she goes back to Italy. Everyone is on edge. Her beloved father, the person who she loves the most, the person who believes in her, the person that Nadia idolizes, is quickly fading. The family keep watch over Osei in the hospital, knowing that they are losing the life that they knew and trying to deal with the impending grief as best as they can and separately, some screaming in their bedrooms and letting others fend for themselves as best as they can. Nadia gets assaulted near a playground and is nearly raped. Her father goes into a coma and dies soon after. Nadia asks her mother to come for the funeral, to be there for her. Nadia's mother refuses. She has a family in Arizona. She just can't come. After being abandoned twice, Nadia doesn't talk to her mother for 10 more years. Annabelle gets a position at the UN agency and takes responsibility for Nadia and Yasmin. Nadia has such a silent rage inside her and starts drinking. Nadia and Annabelle need each other in their grief over losing the person that they loved and competed for. Even though Nadia feels that she could go to live with her Aunt Harriet and she doesn't need to be with Annabelle, she decides ongoingness is what is needed and decides to stay with Annabelle. Annabelle's job takes them to Uganda, where Nadia loses her virginity to a US Marine. At 18, Nadia goes to get a degree in urban planning in the US. Her inheritance from her father soon runs out and she ends up having to work as a waitress to pay for school. She puts a lot of pressure on herself to get good grades, but then she remarks that on interviews, no person ever asked her what her GPA was. Nadia soon ends up semi-parenting her sister and her half-brother, and she resents it. While at the tail end of her four-year relationship with George, Nadia thinks that she could be pregnant, and when the test comes back negative, she remembers words that her Aunt Harriet and Annabelle's sister spoke defending the choices that both women had made, that being a young woman was hard and sympathy and compassion should be given. Owusu explores the concept of living as black in the USA and in Britain. Nadia's brother gets arrested for a crime he didn't commit, and she imagines a scenario that most black mothers dread of being told that their sons or their brothers have been killed by the police. It doesn't end that way for Nadia's brother, though. She also dissects her negative experiences of being an educated, smart, multicultural woman in the US and writes about the ways that language is used as a weapon and of the way that language and code switching also can allow navigation of identity. After holding up and examining moments of her life during her time in the blue chair, Nadia understands that in a way she's deified her father, that she's fanatically worshipped her father, that part of her blue chair madness was caused by a loss of faith. Page 264. When it came to my father, I had forsaken questions. I had created a story of him that served my needs. The story was absolute. It was utilitarian. My story of my father lessened the force of my grief, quelled the quaking. My story was sacred. My father was born of a family both humble and royal, my story went. He grew up brilliant, boundless and black. His brilliance radiated. His blackness radiated. His boundless carried him to America, to abundance, to Europe, back to Africa, to fruition. He helped the poor, fed the hungry. He gave me life. He gave life to Yasmin Kwame. We were his chosen people. He loved us. He was love immaculate. His black star rose. It continued to rise until cancer cut it down. Annabelle had called my story into question. With her story that my father had died of AIDS, she introduced mysteries. She had suggested that my father had kept secrets from us, his chosen people, that he had strayed from us. I shook my head to silence her story. I drank tequila straight. I sat in my window and looked up at the dark New York sky. No stars visible, but they were there, I knew. Black star in the sky, black star father, black star that wasn't visible, but that rose immortal in my heart, in my story. Nadia gets out of the blue chair. She reconnects with her mother and resumes her relationship with Annabelle. There are still lots of questions unanswered, but like the Ghanaian myths, I felt aftershocks had a satisfying ending. She ends the book pouring libations in recognition of her history and her childhood. I really enjoyed this memoir. This book is really a compelling read and beautifully written. I read it over two nights. As I mentioned earlier, the book covers an astonishing amount of ground. Nadia Owusu has an amazing command of storytelling and language. The book is written poetically and I loved the history portions of the memoir. Some might find it non sequitur and busy, but I really enjoyed the beautiful historical, political, anthropological details. It made the book really rich and complex for me. The first night flew by and I really didn't want to put the book down, But for some reason, the second night was harder going. I got bogged down. The writing seemed more uneven, and towards the end, there were places that seemed drawn out and repetitive, which led to my interest waning. I also wasn't sure that the earthquake metaphor worked all the time in the book, and sometimes it seemed a little forced. The other wonderful element about Aftershocks was Nadia Ozu's ability to develop the characters of her father and stepmother. They were really astonishingly alive on the page for me. I could feel Osei's idealism, his love for his daughter and his belief in her and humanity. And Annabelle, gosh, here was a woman who I was ambivalent about initially and actually not really fond at the beginning. But by the end, I had a great deal of admiration for a remarkable and complex woman. Nadia Owusu masterfully painted Annabelle at the beginning, how a jealous child might see her. But the more that she held up the memories of Annabelle and allowed us to see her as a 21-year-old, suddenly married with two stepdaughters far from home, and then widowed and suddenly a breadwinner at 30, the more I really did appreciate her. And maybe that's because I'm coming from an older perspective. I don't know why that happened. The amazing thing about Aftershocks is how sharp, observant, self-aware and honest Nadia Ozu is about examining herself and her family. Ozu is very self-critical and doesn't spare herself. There are no villains or heroines in this book. It's all too human. Sometimes, though, Nadia Ozu can come across as emotionally distant, and I didn't always connect with her. She sometimes came off as self-righteous and unapologetic, and Nadia Ozu frustrated me at times with the choices that she made and the thought process that were going on in her head. But maybe that's totally a me problem, as my child is always telling me, rather than Nadia Ozu's problem. Also, the dislocated way that the memories and narrative in the book are constructed can be problematic and confusing and jumbled for some readers. And some places it felt like that she was dipping in and out of streams of unconsciousness, and some of the chapters feel more surreal than others. However, in some ways, the directionless and the confusion that the narrative created mirrored perhaps what Nadia Ozu was dealing with in that blue chair. Here are some book club questions. What does being black mean in different countries and different regions? Do you think it matters what language you speak? Why or why not? Do you think Nadia Ozu felt a connection to any of the places that she lived in? Which place or places have you felt connections to and why? Nadia Ozu used books to help make sense of the world. Which books have helped you to make sense of the world or shape you? Nadia Ozu lived through two earthquakes and 9/11 and used earthquakes as a metaphor for her life. What metaphors speak to you about your life and why? Nadia Ozu's grandfather tells her, "History is a story. What is told depends on who writes it. Do you agree? And who writes the stories of your family?" I am eagerly looking forward to reading more books by Nadia Ozu and hope you get to read Aftershocks too. Bye-bye!